This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, sitting in for Neal Conan. When he first hit the campaign trail, the pundits gave former Vermont Governor Howard Dean little chance at success in his quest for the Democratic presidential nomination. But Dean managed to tap into a deep vein of Democratic frustration with the status quo. Dean's fiery opposition to the Bush administration's handling of Iraq and the economy, combined with his campaign's skillful use of the Internet, helped him to reach the top of the pack both in overall fundraising and polling in the key states of Iowa and New Hampshire. But now a new entry to the race, Wesley Clark, has surged to the top of some national surveys. Later this hour, Governor Howard Dean will join us to take some of your phone calls. What do you want to ask him about his campaign, his issues, his fundraising, or his opponents? Call us now at 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. You can also email us at totn@npr.org. And as I said, Governor Dean will be joining us in a few minutes by phone from Los Angeles. But first, we do want to talk about his campaign. And joining us here in Studio 3A is NPR's national political correspondent, Mara Liasson. Thanks for being with us, Mara.
Happy to be here, Lynn.
Also with us, Andrew Smith, a professor of political science and director of the Survey Center at the University of New Hampshire in Durham. He's with us from member station WEVO in Concord, New Hampshire. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon.
Professor Smith, first, can you give us a snapshot of some of Howard Dean's political highlights, career highlights in his political career?
Well, Howard Dean is trained as a doctor, so he's coming into the political world as a lieutenant governor in Vermont. He was elected governor, and he was elected, I believe, four-term governor of Vermont. One of the things that is interesting, I haven't heard too much about this, is that his percent re-election numbers have declined in each of his last elections. But he was a pretty popular governor in the state of Vermont. It's important to remember that he's got a reputation now of being a fairly liberal candidate, but during his time in Vermont, he was really not seen that way.
Mara Liasson, let's go over his campaign. What really sets him apart from the other candidates in this race?
Well, I think a couple of things set him apart. First of all, he was the only candidate who didn't have a day job. In other words, he was able to camp out in Iowa and New Hampshire and go there many, many more times than the others, which is not unlike the strategy that Jimmy Carter followed. And he did what I called a mind meld with the frustrations and the anger of the Democratic Party base. He didn't come in as the anti-war candidate, but he was out there talking to a lot of Democrats. He came in as the healthcare candidate, or so he thought, because mm-hmm. he was the doctor. Doctor is in. And he found that the Democratic base, the rank-and-file activists, were really angry. They were angry about the war, and they were angry that their party leaders in Washington seemed to be lying flat on their backs and not taking the fight to George Bush. So he kind of assimilated that anger, and he became the feisty fighting Democrat. And he had a message, a clear message, long before any of the other candidates did, and I think you could argue that some of them still don't, which is, I am an outsider. I'm not of Washington. I'm not a wimp like those other Democrats. Not only am I against the war, but I am going to stand up and say I am against the war to George Bush. I'm against the tax cuts. I wouldn't have voted for the education bill, which most of the Democrats who were running for president did. I wouldn't have voted for the Patriot Act. You know, he had a message of opposition, not just to Bush, loud and clear to Bush, but also to the posture of Democrats in Washington, and that really struck a chord.
And the first place it really became clear that he was resonating was in his fundraising efforts. Let's talk a little bit about that, because he's done something that no other candidate really has done before in terms of his use of the Internet. Isn't that right, Mara?
Well, what he did is the one thing that the early conventional wisdom on Howard Dean was, yes, he's doing great. He struck a chord among the Democratic rank and file. He's kind of the phenomenon in the race, but he's from a small state. He doesn't have a fundraising base. How is he going to raise the tremendous amounts of money that it takes to become the nominee? Lo and behold, he did. He's now surged to the front of the pack, as you said earlier, in terms of fundraising. He did it mostly by using the Internet. He got a lot of small donations. I don't know what the percentage figures are now, but I think he still has the highest percentage of under $250 and under donations, which gives him more matching funds. That's the way the system works. The more small donations you get, the more matching funds you can get. And he did it through the Internet. The other thing that was a phenomenon, the Internet kind of came to him. He mm-hmm. didn't start out, his aides didn't say, oh, we have a vision for the internet. What happened was there's something called Meetup. It's an internet service that helps people form meetings of like-minded folks, whether it's for knitting or cat lovers mm-hmm. or whatever. And meetups around Howard Dean started, not by the Dean campaign officially, and that became a phenomenon. There were Howard Dean meetups all over the country, and those meetups, of course, helped generate more funds for him. So he really has benefited by the internet.
Andy, let's talk about you've been conducting polls in New Hampshire. What issues are voters there? What do they seem to care about? What about Howard Dean is appealing to voters in New Hampshire?
Well, I think it's very important to understand what the Democratic electorate is like in New Hampshire. This is a high education, high income. I would call them Volvo Democrats. These are not blue-collar Democrats in New Hampshire. He's done an excellent job with his opposition to the war and just his antipathy towards Bush. I think Mara touched on this also. He did have a mind meld with the voters here, specifically for New Hampshire. He's an ideal candidate for New Hampshire. I still think that his biggest things that he has going for him up here are his positions on the war, being in opposition to the war. And any candidate is going to do well in a Democratic primary talking about the problems with the Republican administration. The other thing that he really has going for him, and this is more on a personal and a stylistic level, is that he understands that New Hampshire likes outsider candidates. We've had Jimmy Carter, Gary Hart, going back as far as Gene McCarthy, candidates who've been on the outside edges of the party have appealed very strongly to the Democratic electorate here in New Hampshire.
Mara, what about in Iowa? A similar kind of profile?
Well, Iowa, you could make the argument, has more blue-collar voters, so it's slightly different profile, but there is a strong pacifist streak in Iowa that goes back many, many years. So there is deep, deep anti-war sentiment in Iowa that Dean also tapped into. And I think, I mean, I don't know, Andy might correct me, but his surge in Iowa really predated his phenomenal surge in New Hampshire. He was rising to the top there a little bit faster than he did in New Hampshire. And, of course, he spent a lot of time there because he was a neighbor of New Hampshire and he needed to spend more time in Iowa in the very beginning.
Right, and I think that's also because in Iowa you're really dealing with a caucus goer, a much smaller group of people than the electorate here in New Hampshire. We'll have very high turnout. Turnout in the Democratic primary here will approach some turnout that some states have in general elections.
And Andy, also
a lot more people.
Is he better known in New Hampshire because he was the governor of Vermont, right next door? And what's the take on him as governor?
Well, I don't think he was necessarily better known because he was the governor of Vermont, but I think the fact that he came here and campaigned so strongly and spent so much time here over the last six to 9 months is really what's got his name known. His perception is New Hampshireans know him as governor of Vermont for a couple issues. One is with education funding. We're going through some very difficult issues here with changing how the state funds education, from moving it from a local issue to a statewide issue. Governor Dean went through that same problem in Vermont about 3 to 5 years before we did. The second thing that he's known for in New Hampshire is the civil unions issue. Some people think that would be a divisive problem for him in New Hampshire. Actually, it's not. Most Democrats, I think, are with him on support of civil unions.
You're saying civil unions for gay couples?
Yes.
Specifically is what you're referring to there. You know, I just want to ask both of you. You've both, the fact that he is appealing to largely to the sort of affluent white, educated audience, perhaps more blue-collar in Iowa, voter, how... is there any way now of predicting how widespread his appeal is going to be as the race opens up?
Well, that's a big question because South Carolina, which has a very large black population that's going to vote in the Democratic primary, has moved up its primary this year. So it comes right on the heels of Iowa and New Hampshire. It's February 3rd. And the big question, another question about Dean was, can he do well outside of these all-white states like Iowa and New Hampshire, practically all white, he doesn't have a base in the South. He has tried to rectify that. He has a black roommate from college who he talks about a lot. And he says, I can appeal to the kind of Southern white voter who has a gun rack on the back of his car, because among some of the surprising positions that Dean has taken that aren't necessarily boilerplate liberal, he's actually not for more gun laws. He's
right.
For the gun laws that are on the books, and he is for the assault weapons ban and expansion of the Brady Bill. But that is a question about him, what happens to him when he leaves New England and Iowa. That's a place where people think he might have a problem.
Yeah, but I think he's got about 13 million reasons he's going to announce this week about
right.
why he can do better.
Right.
The internet has done two things for him phenomenally that are important. First, the amount of money he's able to raise. He can raise money now independent of him having to go someplace and having dinners and having the typical banquet circuit that candidates have to do. So he frees up his time for campaigning. His fundraising amounts, as Mara pointed out, are very small. I think they're averaging under $100 right now. And that means he can go back and tap these people over and over again. The third thing that it allows him to do with the internet and the meetups is he's got organizations on the ground in these other states now that are somewhat informal, becoming more formal as the campaign rolls along. So he has people that he can touch and put in motion. Now, the boost that a candidate gets out of winning New Hampshire, and I'm thinking right now he's in a good position to win New Hampshire, but you're talking somewhere between a 20 to 25% boost in the national polls. If he can ride that boost along with the money and the organization that he's built up through the internet, he's going to be very, very difficult to stop, regardless of the composition of the electorate.
All right. Mara, you've mentioned earlier that clearly he's opposed to the war in Iraq, opposed to Bush tax cuts. But what are some of the other issues he's really made his own or taken on as his own?
Well, he came in as the health care candidate. He has a health care plan that is actually surprisingly more moderate and incremental and less ambitious than, for instance, Dick Gephardt's. It's basically to expand the existing health care programs and see if they can take in some of the uninsured, not all of the uninsured. He is someone who in the past has been for NAFTA and for free trade. He was a Clinton-like free trader in that respect, although now he's said that we have to go back and renegotiate every single trade treaty to include tougher environmental and labor and human rights standards. So he has changed his tone on that, if not his actual position. I mentioned gun control, where he has a position that worked well in Vermont. Vermont doesn't have a lot of crime, and he thinks that most gun laws should be up to the states. I think that on the tax cuts, what's interesting, and this is something that I think will be fought out in New Hampshire because Kerry is really taking aim on him on this. I don't know if you could call it liberal or not. Howard Dean is against all of the Bush tax cuts. Kerry and Edwards and some of the other candidates are for keeping the middle class tax cuts. Now, is it liberal to be against middle class tax cuts or is it liberal to be for them? I mean, I think that's something that the voters in New Hampshire mm-hmm. will have to decide. But he says that we have to balance the budget. And in order to do this, we have to get rid of all the tax cuts, even the ones that the Democrats fought to insert in the Bush plan. We'll see if that's something that really hurts him in New Hampshire. Maybe Andy can shed some light on that. I don't know if it is.
Andy?
Yeah, I think that's really important because New Hampshire, we've got the traditional Democratic and Republican cleavage, but there's this other anti-tax cleavage that exists in New Hampshire. In the last election, we had a Democrat that ran for governor on a pro-income tax platform and did very, very poorly, won 35-38% of the vote. Democrats don't like taxes here either, not quite as much as the Republicans, but it's an anti-tax state. And if some of his opponents can frame him, his opposition to taxes as not just being opposed to tax cuts, but actually de facto in favor of tax increases, then that might be a weakness for him here.
Yeah, just one other factor that's new and that might be affecting Dean in New Hampshire, and I'm curious to see what Andy's noticed up there, is all of a sudden there is another anti-war outsider in the race, and that's Clark.
Right.
He is the perfect anti-Dean vehicle in the eyes of many, many Democrats who don't want Dean to get the nomination.
Very quickly, Andy, if you can respond to that. Very quickly.
Wesley Clark's still unknown in the state. He's got a problem in that he's perceived as more of a moderate Democrat, and he's fighting with Gephardt, Lieberman, Graham, John Edwards for that maybe 40% of the Democratic electorate up here.
Right.
He's going to have difficulty.
Thanks so much, Andy. Andy Smith is a professor of political science at the University of New Hampshire. He joined us from member station WEVO in Concord. Mara, stay with us and give us a call if you'd like to talk to Howard Dean, 800-989-TALK. I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Thank you. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington, and joining us on the phone now from Los Angeles is Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. Welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Well, nice to be on.
Let's start out with Iraq. You said yesterday on Face the Nation, I'm quoting now, we have to turn Iraq from an American occupation to an international reconstruction. So far, there's little indication the international community is really ready to get involved with Iraq in a big way. How would you accomplish that goal?
I think one of the reasons that we're seeing a lot of reluctance in the international community is that the president has poisoned relations, our relationships with most of the other countries that we're going to need help from. Their attitude at this point is, look, you got yourself into this and snubbed us on the way, and you can get yourself out of this. I think it's going to take a new president to get us out of Iraq, and it's going to take a repairing of the personal relations between the president of the United States and the leadership of the other countries.
How do you go about repairing those relations?
Well, you need to have personal relationships with them. You need to go meet them early. I've met some of them, but I really need to go, should I become the president-elect, I would need to go to Europe and some other parts of the world before I was inaugurated in order to begin the process of recalibrating our relations with foreign leaders. I also think, you know, I was frankly very pleased when President Bush said very early in his term that he was going to concentrate on this hemisphere, and of course that hasn't happened. We really need to do that. Our relationships with Mexico and Canada are also particularly poor right now, and we need to fix that. So before, should I become the president-elect, before I am inaugurated, I will meet with both the president of Mexico and the prime minister of Canada and with a variety of European heads of state in order to begin to repair our international relationships with this, which this president, frankly, has left in tatters.
You know, a lot of Democratic voters may oppose the Bush administration's policy on Iraq, but they're also really worried about the threat of terrorism and national security. Some of those voters are probably considering Wesley Clark more seriously now. He's opposed to the war in Iraq, but is perceived to be strong on national security issues because of his military background. How do you offset that appeal?
Well, I think that one of the problems that Democrats are going to have with Wes, who incidentally is a very good guy and is very good on national security issues, I think, is that he essentially was a Republican until 25 days ago. He voted for Reagan. He voted for Nixon. He's on tape, apparently, I saw on MSNBC, praising Vice President Cheney, praising Secretary Rumsfeld, whose resignation I asked for last week based on his misleading the United States Congress and the public on the Iraq matter. So Harry Truman said if you run a Republican against a Republican, the Republican wins every time. And I think that's really problematic. It's going to be very hard for Democrats to swallow putting a Republican at the top of the ticket in order to beat George Bush. I really want change in this country. I want to change our party so it stands up to be democratic again. And I want to change the country so we have balanced budgets and a much more progressive social policy. And I did that in Vermont. I have a record of doing that. A third of our our seniors have prescription benefits, for example, in my state. The folks in Washington haven't accomplished any of that, and they've been there for a long time. And I think that will weigh also heavily on voters' minds when they make their choice of who to nominate for the Democratic nomination.
Do you think the fact that you're an outsider to Washington and that you are running as an outsider, that that's one of the reasons that people are responding to your campaign?
I do. I think people are fed up with Washington, period. They don't like this administration because of what he's done to the country, what the president's done both economically with these enormous deficits and job losses. And for the first time, we are held in very low regard around the rest of the world as a result of this presidency. But I also think they look at the insiders and think, well, what have these folks really accomplished? They're good people. Believe me, if I don't win the nomination, I'm going to support whoever does. But they've been there for a long time. We still don't have health insurance. We still don't have a balanced budget. We did have when Bill Clinton was there, but he was an outsider, and we needed somebody from the outside to come in. I think it's very tough to put somebody from inside Washington or somebody like General Clark, who's backed essentially by people from inside Washington, and then expect there to be real change in the Democratic Party or in the country.
You and the other candidates did not challenge Wesley Clark in the debate in New York very much. Why not? Why did you hold off?
Well, one of the reasons I didn't challenge him is I didn't know that he had that he was a Republican. I mean, I had talked to him. Actually, I talked to him on the phone and in person probably six or seven times up until the time he declared, and none of that had ever come out. I was really stunned when I saw the tape from MSNBC saying all those nice things about Vice President Cheney and Secretary Rumsfeld. I just didn't know that that was part of his background.
I should point out, I think that he has said that as a member of the military, he was not a member of any political party. Is that correct?
Well, that may be true, but his voting record certainly makes it appear that he was, if not a member of the Republican Party, certainly a pretty faithful Republican. I mean, it's one thing to vote for somebody once in a while. I voted for Jim Jeffords one time, who's always was my kind of Republican, although he's not one anymore, much to his credit. This is right down the line. Nixon, Reagan twice, praise for President Bush, praise for Secretary Rumsfeld, praise for Dick Cheney, Condoleezza Rice. That's tough to swallow, no matter where he is now. And I respect his right to change his mind, but no matter where he is now, that is going to be tough for Democrats to swallow. We don't have to have a general just because he's a Republican. I think we can have strong national security policies. This president has not been very strong on national security. He chose tax cuts over inspection of cargo containers, and last week a major news organization smuggled uranium from Jakarta, Indonesia, into Los Angeles. We didn't find it. He chose tax cuts over purchasing the enriched uranium stocks of the Soviet Union, which we're entitled to buy under cooperative threat reduction. If that gets in terrorist hands, then we have a major national security emergency. The president's about to let North Korea become a nuclear power because he doesn't like them, so he won't authorize bilateral negotiations. And I just don't think this president understands that part of the defense of the United States of America is not just having a strong military. That's important. But it's also having a high moral purpose and a set of ideals to which other countries aspire. That's part of our defense.
Governor Dean, we've got a lot of people that want to talk to you, so I'd like to get a call in
here
if we could. And the number to call is 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Raphael in Baltimore, Maryland. Hi, Raphael.
Hello, how are you?
Good.
Hi.
I'm Governor Dean, how are you?
Good.
Good. I was watching Meet the Press yesterday, and Gephardt was on there attacking you by suggesting that you sided with Gingrich and the Gingrich Revolution in their attempt to cut money to Medicare. Could you explain your comments? He said some comments about you saying it was the worst program ever or something like that, and your stance on Medicare.
I'm a huge supporter of Medicare. One-third of all the seniors in my state have prescription benefit, which Representative Gephardt and the other folks have never managed to deliver to the seniors around the country. The problem is Medicare is a badly run program. My father passed away about 2 years ago. I couldn't even figure out the hospital bills. I'm a doctor, and so I know what it's like to practice under Medicare. It's not very well run. It's very bureaucratic. But it's a great program because it takes care of seniors who would otherwise have no recourse. You know, I think Dick, to be honest with you, I like Dick Gephardt, and I worked for him in 1988, but he's falling further and further behind, and he's now trying the Hail Mary pass. And I was the first person that took on Newt Gingrich when all the other Democrats in Washington were paralyzed. So, you know, this is just campaign nonsense to try to make me sound like Newt Gingrich. If you look at my record in Vermont, health care for every child under 18, or almost every child under 18, prescription benefits for a third of the seniors, health care for working people, it becomes obvious that Dick is just throwing mud and hope some of it sticks.
All right, thanks for your call, Raphael. We're going to move to another call now. Let's go to, I think it's Nefer in Portland, Oregon. Hi.
Hello.
Hi, go ahead.
Okay. First of all, I'd just like to say that I have great admiration and respect for you. In fact, I'm hosting a small house party for you tonight here in Portland.
Oh, thank you. I'll be calling into it, I think.
I know it, and I'm psyched. But I do have some concerns and questions. I'm basically rallying for you and been supporting you and will do so up until the point where I feel like it's someone else could beat Bush, because I think that's the most important thing.
Mm-hmm.
But my concerns are, one, about I've heard that you don't support the Kyoto Accord, and also I want to know if you're truly in your heart pro-capital punishment or if this is just a political move.
I do think there are some times that capital punishment is justified. The murder of a child, the shooting of a police officer, somebody who blows up hundreds of people. I'm certainly not we have no capital punishment in Vermont, and we don't need any, and I never tried to get any. And I certainly would not do what John Ashcroft does. I think the biggest issue in capital punishment for me is the fairness with which it's administered, which is clearly not fair now. You're much more likely to be condemned to death for killing a white person than you are for a black person, for example, in this country. And certainly John Ashcroft's philosophy has no place in any Dean administration. I will not, I'll have an attorney general who is fair-minded and who is not going to be overriding local prosecutors. It is not true that I don't support the Kyoto Accord. What I have said is Kyoto is not perfect, and we can't sign it now, but we need to fix it so we can sign it. The problem with Kyoto is it does not require big industrial giants like China and Brazil to do anything about global warming. And so it needs really to be to include those countries, and they can have a longer timeline in terms of getting involved in Kyoto, and we could even, with international groups, help them with some of their equipment. But I don't think we can exempt the developing world from the requirements of Kyoto. And I actually signed an executive order which brings Vermont emissions underneath the Kyoto limitations. So I do very much support attacks on global warming, and Kyoto is the most important one.
All right, thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Thanks for your time. And that brings me to the question of free trade. You supported NAFTA, but now you're saying that that our trade agreements have to be modified to include internationally recognized standards on human rights, the environment, labor conditions. What if countries like China, for instance, would say, sorry, we can't do that? What would our policy on trade with China be then?
China's going to be a huge problem for us. I not only supported NAFTA because that was very good for Vermont, I also supported China's entry into the WTO, and the reason I did that is because I thought it was a national security issue. If you trade with countries, they're much likely, less likely to really take extreme measures like attacking. And China has proved that when the spy plane was returned and the crew after 10 days early in this president's administration, because they didn't want to lose hundreds of billions of dollars worth of trade. Nonetheless, our trade relationship with China is unfair, and I believe that we've got to revisit both NAFTA, the WTO arrangements, to do what happens in the European Union. You can't get into the European Union, which is essentially a free trade zone, without having the same labor and environmental standards and human rights standards throughout the Union. We need to do that elsewhere. It is not fair for us to be importing soccer balls made by 12-year-olds stitched together who get 50 cents an hour or 50 cents a day or whatever they may get paid. China's going to be a huge problem with that, and there's going to be a lot of friction there. But we can't go on the way we've done. You know, Vermont did well under free trade because we're right up against the Canadian border. Our trade with Canada tripled when the first free trade agreement went in. But the Midwest has been hollowed out by it. All of our industrial jobs are leaving, good-paying jobs for people, and there are no jobs to replace them. People are working for a quarter, a third, or a half of what they made previously. We can't continue like that in this country, and we've got to have fair trade.
Yeah. Let me ask you about your position on tax cuts. You've said that you would repeal all the Bush tax cuts.
Mm-hmm.
Some of your Democratic opponents say that would repeal the middle-class tax cuts they fought
for.
Well,
you know, the truth is the middle class never really got a tax cut. They got a couple of checks, some of them. The average middle-class person who makes $45,000 a year in New Hampshire, for example, got about a $460 tax cut. 60% of Americans got less than $350. But whatever you got, think of what your college tuition's gone up, your kids' college tuition. Think how much your property taxes have gone up because of what the president's done. He cut taxes, all right, but he also cut Pell Grants. He cut fire and police protection. He cut Homeland Security protection, first response, aid to colleges, aid to education, didn't fund special ed, all those things that would reduce your property taxes. So the average person in this country, my guess is, has seen their property taxes go up far more and their college tuitions go up far more than the $300 or $400 or $500 they got. I just think the other Democrats in the race are just not looking at the real problem. The real problem is the Bush tax cuts, and for them to defend part of them doesn't make any sense. We ought to get rid of them and start all over again with a sensible tax policy that's fair to the middle class.
We are talking with the Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. If you'd like to join the conversation, the number is 1-800-989-8255, and you can also email us at totn@npr.org. And you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Dr. Dean, if you do well in New Hampshire and Iowa, you're going to be moving on to southern states very quickly after those races with large black populations. Your base of support is mostly white. You come from a state that's mostly white. How can you reach out to minority voters? That's such an important part of the Democratic base. How are you going to do that?
It is a very important part of the Democratic base, and we are reaching out to African-American, Latino, Native American, and Asian American in particular voters because my platform is helpful to everybody, but it's particularly helpful to members of the minority community. First of all, in order to get jobs in this country, we ought to be helping small businesses, not big corporations. Big corporations pay better, but they also move their jobs to other states and to other countries. Small businesses create more jobs than big businesses do, and they tend to keep their businesses in their community and in the United States. Secondly, I want to invest in infrastructure, in schools, in mass transit, in roads, broadband telecommunications, renewable energy. These are things that create jobs now and build an infrastructure for later. All those things address. And also, my record is I have health insurance in my state for almost every child. Minority children are disproportionately lack health insurance. So that everything I'm going to do is going to help all Americans, but it's particularly going to help members of the minority community who have been left behind in the last 10 years.
All right, let's take a call. Bob in Sacramento, California. Hi, Bob.
Hi, I'm in Sacramento. I'm a doc myself, and I've worked with medical students. I've been following Dr. Dean's career through the new physician, the medical student thing. I was also at the state convention in Sacramento this February when I really saw fire in the belly in Dr. Dean. But it seems to me that Dr. Dean came into the race, number one, as a physically responsible candidate. This war sort of fell in his way. Now he's getting bagged as health and anti-war. But my question sort of is what would be your plan to get back to a balanced budget and hopefully pay off so our kids don't have to pay 20% of federal taxes, mainly from their middle class and poor, for a big transfer to the rich and the very rich?
All right, let's ask Dr. Dean. Go ahead with that.
I am a fiscal conservative, and it's true. And we always balance the budget in our state. I actually served long enough, so I was governor through both Bush recessions, not just one. And after the first one, we put aside a lot of money. We did not give big tax cuts. We gave some. We paid off a quarter of the state's debt. And as a result, during the second recession, we did not have to cut things like higher education or K-12 or health care for kids or aid to cities and towns, and we still balance the budget. Now, it's going to be tough. This president has dug us a really, really big hole, $500 billion deficit. It's just staggering what he's done to us. And the first thing we got to do is get rid of the tax cuts. The other reason, we talked a little bit about the tax cuts earlier. You know, the other guys in the race, all Washington politicians, or else supported by Washington politicians, are doing the same old dance. You can have tax cuts and health insurance and fund special ed. That's just not true. One of the reasons we decided to get rid of the entire tax cut is we knew we couldn't pay for our health insurance plan unless we did. You've got to tell the American people the truth. They're so sick of all this Washington BS, and we're going to. So the plan to balance the budget is get rid of the tax cuts. That's $3 trillion over 10 years. That really makes a big difference. It's $2.4 trillion in tax cuts, and it's $600 billion in interest costs that the president's paying to borrow the money. Then you are going to have to restrain the growth of the federal budget, and there's not any question about that. People have said, well, that means you're going to cut Social Security? No, it doesn't mean you're going to cut Social Security. Social Security is a separate program. It ought to be run separately. And it actually is reasonably fiscally safe. People are always pulling that out. Oh, you got to raise the Social Security tax or this or that or the other.
You're going to change the age for Social Security to 70?
No, you don't need to change the age for Social Security. 67 is just fine.
You don't want to lose those baby boomer votes, you know.
Well, I am a baby boomer vote, and I don't get to retire until I'm about 66. But in any case, you do have to restrain. You got to get rid of the tax cuts to start to balance the budget, and then you do have to restrain spending.
Well, Dr. Dean, thanks so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
Okay.
And I love that Moonlight in Vermont intro.
Okay. Howard Dean is the Democratic presidential candidate. He is one of the Democratic presidential candidates. He spoke with us from Los Angeles. And I'm Lynn Neary. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Lynn Neary in Washington. Tomorrow, an update on poverty rates in America and a look at how changing the way we define poverty could change the way we understand it. Before the break, we were speaking with Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean. Still with us here in Studio 3A is Mara Liasson. She's NPR's national political correspondent. And joining us from studios at Stanford University in California is history professor David Kennedy. Thanks for being with us, Professor Kennedy.
Glad to be here.
If you have any questions, questions about the what you just heard from Democratic presidential candidate Howard Dean and his campaign, give us a call at 1-800-989-8255. And, Mara, you've been following the campaign more closely than I have. Did you hear anything new at all?
Well, I certainly didn't hear anything new from Dr. Dean about his positions. The one thing that I did hear was new was his comments about Wesley Clark. He, like all the other candidates in the debate in New York last Thursday, chose to practically ignore Clark. And we know that Dean had some conversations with Clark a couple weeks ago where he actually proposed the idea of the two of them being this ready-made ticket where Clark runs as Dean's number two. But I thought he was quite harsh, saying that he's a Republican. You know, that Democrats are going to find this tough to swallow. We don't have to have a general on the top of the ticket if he's a Republican. You know, he mentioned several times the fact that he voted twice for Reagan and for Nixon, and he praised Cheney and Rumsfeld and Bush. Those are really boogeymen to the Democratic rank and file. And this is, I think, going to be the tack that the other Democratic candidates take against Clark to the extent that they criticize him at all. I think the fact that Dean chose to today suggests that he perceives Clark as something of a threat, especially in New Hampshire. You know, as we said before, he is another anti-war Democrat, but one who has sterling national security credentials, and that's something that Dean lacks.
Professor Kennedy, as you heard, we talked a little bit to Dr. Dean about his status as an outsider in this race, or presenting himself as an outsider in this race. He also has the label of the liberal, I think, or the most liberal in the race. Is he really?
Well, I thought it actually was quite interesting the way he himself distinguished himself from a lot of traditionally liberal positions. He emphatically said he's a fiscal conservative. He's in favor of capital punishment in some cases. He's not made a forward issue of gun control policy. He's in favor of free trade with some modifications, to be sure. Those are not the, in the modern context at least, the traditionally liberal issues. So, and as somebody at the top of your hour, Andrew Smith, said, he was not perceived as particularly liberal when he was governor of Vermont. So it's a bit of an oddity that he now stands in the, has been cast in the role as the leftmost candidate in the Democratic array.
Well, where is that coming from? Where is that perception then coming from?
Well, it may be in part some kind of a media creation. I suppose the fact that he has attached himself so firmly to the anti-war position lends itself to some kind of easy liberal characterization. But if you look at the spectrum of his opinions on other policies, it makes you wonder if Howard Dean today defines the leftmost point of the political spectrum in this country, the viable presidential political spectrum, what has happened to the center of gravity of the system as a whole? It must have shifted considerably rightward in the last generation.
Mara, you want to
I don't think that Dean is a liberal. I think that a lot of his supporters are, and I think that that's where this labeling began. I think that a lot of the left wing of the Democratic Party is enamored of him, and they have chosen to overlook his views on free trade or gun control or capital punishment because he's been so ardent against the war and because he expresses their anger so perfectly at George W. Bush. I mean, if you're really a liberal in terms of position papers, you'd go for Kucinich or Sharpton. But I agree with Professor Kennedy. I mean, he's not a liberal in the traditional sense of the word. And I think, you know, you heard that one caller saying, gee, are you really against capital punishment or is this just a political position? Right. She didn't seem too deterred by it. I think that his liberalism is more of almost more of a stylistic thing, just that he's chosen to be so much more in opposition to Bush and so much more energetically opposed to him than
and
the
probably
other
the issue, the biggest issue of this race, it's not even an issue, but perhaps the most important part of this race for Democrats is opposition to the presidency of George W. Bush.
That's right. And I think what you see Democrats wrestling with when I go out and talk to Democratic voters on the trail is their heart. A lot of their hearts are with Dean because he's saying the things and expressing them in the way that they like against Bush. But they want someone who can beat Bush. And you heard that caller from California, and I thought she was very emblematic because she says, I'm going to support you until somebody else comes along who I think can beat Bush more than you. I mean, people want to beat Bush.
Right.
They don't want to just, cast a vote for somebody that